Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Robbie Robertson, like many of his generation, became enamored with rock and roll in the 1950s and began a musical journey that drew inspiration from his Native American roots, rhythm and blues, and folk. His group, the band, shaped by the multi-instrumental talents and varying vocal stylings of its members, stood alone in a time of heavily psychedelic rock. They inspired the sound of many established artists and left behind a rich legacy, including, of course, this song.
Just need some place where I can lay my head. Hey, mister, can you tell me where a man might find a bed? He just grinned and shook my hand. No was all he said.
A new documentary called Once We're Brothers, directed by Daniel Rohr, was inspired by Robertson's 2017 best-selling memoir, Testimony. The film chronicles Robertson's young life and the creation of one of the most enduring groups in the history of popular music up until The Last Waltz. Once We're Brothers, Robbie Robertson and the band opens in theaters on February 21st. I spoke with them late last week when they were in town for a special screening of the film. I began by asking Robbie how he knew that Daniel Rohr was the right director for this film.
You know, you just kind of go on instinct, and I've been doing that most of my life, and I've learned to trust it. And, you know, I've said this before, but you know, when we were talking about it, and then at one point in our first meeting, I said to Daniel, by the way, how old are you? And he said, 24. And I thought, I think that's good. I was 24 when I made Music from Big Pink. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I just had a...
Daniel, why did you just shake your head?
Like, well, it's insane to think about that. Like, it's incredible. He made that record when he was 24. It's like you know.
Yeah, what were you doing? Well, I know what you were doing.
Well,
when you were 24.
I know, but still, it's like it's just unbelievable to think about. And every time I hear that, I'm unbelievable.
So, Daniel, your work as a filmmaker wasn't really about music, but you are a Robertson super fan. Initially, what drew you to the way we're going to talk about you like you're not here, Robbie? What drew you to the way Robbie Robertson writes?
Well, there's a storybook quality to his songs that I immediately gravitated towards as a young person. Mm-hmm. You know, in the film, someone says that it's like Faulkner or Steinbeck. The songs have the capacity to really transport you to another time and place. And that's because of the writing, that's because of the musicianship, that's because of the vocals and the singing. And it was just an extraordinary type of music. And Bruce Springsteen says it best in the film. It's like you'd never heard it before, but it had always been there. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of how I always connected with it. It was just awesome. I don't know how else to describe it.
What drew you to Robbie's life story?
Well, Robbie's story reads like fiction. I mean, I always thought that Robbie was kind of like, the Forrest Gump of contemporary popular music. He was always in the right place at the right time, doing extraordinary things, whether that's being a 16-year-old and going down south or hooking up with Bob Dylan, or being in Woodstock as the band. But ultimately, what Robbie's life really embodies to me and what I learned from him making this movie is that in order to find success, you have to be bold and you have to be outside of your comfort zone and do things that are crazy, like dropping out of high school and joining some Southern rockabilly band as a Canadian kid. There's just a boldness and a vividness to the man's life that I was so inspired by. And of course, the musicality, all of these ingredients came together, and I just identified that this would be an extraordinarily exciting film to make.
That is an amazing story of you leaving Canada, coming down to the Deep South. When you got there, what was a cultural difference that excited you? And then what was something that you really had to get your head wrapped around?
Well, coming from Canada, it was so night and day. But to me, I was going to the place where this music that I was addicted to, it all came out of this Mississippi Delta area. And I thought, what is going on there? This is so magical. This was like going to the holy land of rock and roll. And there's like a 100-mile radius or something where all this was happening, and I didn't understand how this could be. And so I was so excited to be going to this place, and it was exactly that. They were everywhere, from these people from Memphis to Clarksdale, Mississippi. All of these music people were there. And, you know, they'd be off, you know, playing somewhere, but this was their home. This is where they came back to. And so that was just thrilling to me. 16 years old, you know, you think, these are all my heroes. Mm-hmm. These guys are amazing. They changed the world to me. But then there was this part of segregation, too, at that time. This was 1960. And in Arkansas and in Tennessee, it was in full bloom. And I'd never seen anything like that. You know, in Canada, you know, it's so remote. Mm-hmm. It's like Sweden, you know, compared to Africa or something, mm-hmm. you know. So anyway, that I did have trouble wrapping my head around. And I never got comfortable at all with it, because a lot of the people I was working with, they grew up in mm-hmm. there, and they were used to it. And where Levon was, my partner in this group, the Hawks at the time, the town that he lived in, there was 8 blacks to 1 white. And so they, you know, they had an incredible relationship. But it was built on a traditional Southern attitude. And there was part of it, I thought, this is beautiful. Everybody kind of has this love for one another. But one day in the car, we were going somewhere, and there was a guy that had worked with his family and everything, mm-hmm. a black guy, and Levon said, come on, let us give you a lift in the town. He said, sit up here. And he said, oh no, I'm not sitting up there. He said, I'll sit back there, but I will not sit up here. And it was like, wow. Isn't that something? These rules are so ingrained. And it was so weird and so unnecessary, but that was coming from a Canadian point of view.
Were you, by the time you got there, did you think of yourself as a kid, or were you a young man yet?
I didn't want to think of myself as a kid, because I had a lot to achieve. I had a lot to convince these people of. Because when I went down there, I was trying out for something that was impossible. You had to be 21 to play in the places that they played in. I wasn't experienced. I wasn't a good enough guitar player. And I was trying to join a Southern rockabilly band. There's no Canadians in Southern rockabilly bands. That was almost an oxymoron. So I had a lot of convincing to do, and I had a lot of work to do.
My guests are Robbie Robertson and Daniel Rohr. We're talking about the film Once Were Brothers, Robbie Robertson and the band. There are also these great photos of your family, of your mom especially. And it was interesting to learn about you. You learn about your family. We learn about your family some interesting things. You spent your summers visiting your mom's relatives at the Six Nations First Nations Reserve in Canada. How did that experience influence you as a musician and as a songwriter?
Well, my introduction that this film addresses pretty well, my introduction into inside of music was at the Six Nations Indian Reserve. Everybody played music, because that was all they had. That was all the entertainment they had. So all my uncles and aunts and cousins and everybody seemed to me, anyway, like they played an instrument, sang or danced. And I thought, I want to be part of this. And, you know, you don't want to be left out. And it sounded so good. to have it happen right in front of you. I'd never been that close to a musical experience like that. And it was like a magnet to me. And it just pulled me in. And pretty soon I was part of it. Pretty soon I was growing in that area and I was becoming better. And I actually, I don't know, maybe 12 years old, I thought, I'm getting as good at this as any of these guys, you know. I said to myself, you know.
Did you believe it?
They were still teaching me.
Okay.
So I didn't want to say it out loud, but I was getting some confidence. And then I was off and running. Then I'm 13 years old. I'm reaching puberty. I'm already standing at the crossroads with the guitar and rock and roll comes flying out of jukeboxes from coast to coast. And I thought, this is my calling. This is everything. I didn't know it, but this is everything I've been waiting for. And I just got pulled in that direction. And it all started. And it's funny in the film that Daniel shows these pictures of me, you know, with a little guitar mm-hmm. when I was a kid with a cowboy on it. But it was the irony was there was Indians teaching me how to play it. You know? So everybody had a good sense of humor about this.
I get the sense that your mom was a really important person to you and in your life. What life lessons did you learn from her that you still think about today?
There was a lot of things along the way, like what we're talking about. She was born and raised on the reservation from the Mohawk Nation. So she grew up and they were sent to schools to take the Indian out of you.
Right.
And so then her mother died, and she was sent to the city to live with an aunt, right, which it talks about in the film, too. And when she got to the city, she was taught something that years later she passed on to me. And she said, be proud you're an Indian, but be careful who you tell. And that was her experience. Wow. She went to the city, and her aunt said, listen, you could pass. You could pass for anybody here as long as they don't see you in the summertime because, you know, your skin, you know, shows up. So anyway, it was just this thing that you live with, mm-hmm. and I don't know, something in that too contributed to that boldness that Daniel was talking about. Some of it was like, oh, this is going to be a fight. Let's have a fight.
Bring it.
You know, yeah. I just thought, okay, I'm not expecting this to be easy. It was never, ever easy. But I pretty much liked to get in there and mix it up.
My guests are Robbie Robertson and Daniel Rohr. We're talking about the documentary Once Were Brothers, Robbie Robertson and the Band. There are so many great musicians who bear witness in this film. Who was someone, Daniel, you knew you had to include, that you knew was really important to have to be able to tell the story the way you wanted to tell it?
Oh, gosh, there's so many individuals. I think one person who comes to mind that gave me just such an extraordinary recount with his whole heart and soul was one of Robbie's old friends, Eric Clapton. And what I didn't expect when I went into that interview was how candid and honest Mr. Clapton would be when it comes to substance abuse and chemical addiction. And he spoke with just so profoundly about how he remembers drinking with Richard, for example, Richard Manuel, one of the singers in the band. And, you know, he said something to me like, Richard and him liked to drink together. But then they'd go home and drink on their own. And that's sort of when things become really dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so that was an interview that just provided an insight that I wasn't necessarily expecting out of him. And he was so generous and could speak with such authority on the subject. And you know, I think interviews like that with individuals of his stature really helped to destigmatize addiction, chemical addiction, mental health issues, and challenges like those.
You have been listening to my conversation with Robbie Robertson and director Daniel Rohr about the documentary Once We're Brothers. It's in theaters February 21st. More of that conversation after a quick break. Stay with us. Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Let's return to my conversation with Robbie Robertson and director Daniel Rohr. We're talking about the new documentary, Once We're Brothers, about Robbie Robertson and the band.
What did you come to understand about making music in this period of time that maybe you didn't really understand before?
You know, something that was really highlighted for me, and maybe this is something Robbie can speak to, but it just seemed like, you know, there was Bob Dylan, and then there was everybody else. And what I really came to appreciate was how he sort of occupied his own world. And I thought that was just so unique.
Hmm.
And when it comes to the band themselves, you know, what I really admired was how the entire musical scene, popular music landscape, was tuning into like psychedelic type sounds and vibes and guitar solos that went on forever, whereas the band went the other way. Their music was more homespun. I think Robbie's one of the best guitar players of all time because he never played a note that he didn't have to play. Everything was really precise, and there was so much power in the simplicity there, and that's something that always really captivated me.
Was the precision intentional, Robbie?
I had, when I started out, everything I played was on fire. And I was reaching for 11 all the time in my playing. And I did that with Ronnie Hawkins. I did it with the Hawks when we left Ronnie. I did it with Bob Dylan. And by now, a lot of these other guys were doing that. And I thought, well, it's becoming ordinary. And then I started to think, there was something in the band, there was an old soul in this group, for sure. And I started to feel like, you know what's really important in this? Are the subtleties, the things that just barely make it in time, that feeling, that thing like, you know, there was things like with Miles Davis, he could play one note, and that sound, you knew it was him, and all you needed was that one note. And I thought, that's so pure. I want to become this person. And there was other guitar players at the time, Curtis Mayfield, that played just everything was just enough. Mm-hmm. Never too much. And I thought, I'm going to teach myself to go in a different direction. And that was one of the appeals to somebody like Eric Clapton and George Harrison and many other guitar players, was the subtleties, mm-hmm. what you leave out. The space between those notes is just as important as the notes. And so that was quite a compliment because they knew I had been there and done that.
This film is about relationships, you know, men who are like brothers, but are also co-workers as well. It's an interesting dynamic. What did you want to explore about that dynamic in the film?
Well, it's funny because I didn't grow up playing music. When I got this job, I started taking guitar lessons, but I was never in a band. And what I came to realize is that there is something awesome and almost impossible about this very unique creative collaboration. And one of the interviews that I did that really highlighted this was with Bruce Springsteen. And what Bruce Springsteen reminded me is that this is a relationship that you start sometimes, in this case, when you're 16, 17 years old, and you are business partners, and you have to see each other every day, and meanwhile, you're growing and changing and starting to have families and growing up together. And that can be really, really, really challenging, almost impossible. And that's really what I wanted the film to be about these five young men doing the very best they could and making music to change the world.
Robbie, what is that challenge of having your brothers be your co-workers, be the person you depend upon on stage, but you're still individuals, but you make up a band, the band. How do you balance all that out? How did you balance all of that?
Well, you know, when we start, well, I started playing with Levon when I was 16 years old. And then the rest of the guys came in the over a period of the next couple of years. So we grew up together. And we were a brotherhood. And we were back to back. And we played in places. The danger is hard to imagine now. Craziness. And we went through this whole span, this whole horizon of experiences together. But as you're going along, you're also growing up and growing in different directions. And, you know, people are going off and raising a family and everything. So it doesn't stay like that. And you would try to adapt to each of these pieces of your evolution. And some of it is easy and it works. And some of it becomes distant. And a change. And then in the film, as Daniel addresses very soulfully, is something we had no knowledge about whatsoever, was because in this period of the 60s and 70s, experimenting was running amok, right? And everybody was like, did you try this? Oh my God, I got some of those. Want to check that out? And everywhere we went, people were wanting to turn you on. That was their way of infiltrating into your life. So this was just getting stronger and stronger. And what we didn't have knowledge about was addiction. Because it was like one person could do this and say, oh, that was kind of fun. I'm done. And another person was like, no, I think I need to experience this more and all the time. And so one would say, what are you doing? That's making you sleep in too late or not show up or not do your job as well. Why would you want to do that? You know? And they were like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm just enjoying myself. And so these differences really do start. And it wasn't unique in this group. This was widespread. There was many, many bands that there was interior problems that grew out of addictions. So we tried to adjust to that. Tried and tried and tried, and sometimes you would get to a point that you could recognize this thing was bigger than you. This thing was more powerful than your words or your intentions, and you're going to have to work around that because you're not going to make that go away. So this went on, and it's a progressive disease too, addiction. So it went to a place that I finally had to say, guys, we got to get off the road. Somebody's going to die, and we've got to stop this. We have to bring this to a fantastic conclusion and a celebration of music. Let's do The Last Waltz. And everybody at the time thought of that as a relief. Oh, my God, that could be great. And really to celebrate this journey that we had been on and to do it with these incredible friends of ours that are musical giants. And so this whole thing and the way that all came together was completely magical. And it did bring us to a beautiful culmination of everything that we had experienced. And then thinking, now we could stop, take a breath, and figure out, if possible, how to help one another in this situation.
The film The Last Waltz is directed by Martin Scorsese, who's someone you've worked with a lot.
A lot.
A lot, most recently on The Irishman.
Yeah.
And many other films. What do you like about working with him? Why are you guys a good pair?
I like working with Marty because he's pretty fearless in the work that he does. He is maybe, the best filmmaker there is. I mean, give or take, you know what I mean? He's a, you know, he's my favorite. And besides us being very dear friends and everything, we have a musical and film language and collaboration. And I don't even remember how many movies of his I've worked on now, but it's, you know, I don't know, it's up there around 10 or something like that. But anyway, every time it's a different game and we start all over again. And I love that. And every time I say to myself, oh my God, I have no idea what to do here. What is this animal? How do we make this thing work? And sometimes it, you know, it starts to blend together and it comes together. Sometimes it's impossible to figure out. But somewhere in that darkness, we find a light and we find our way to the other end. And when we do, what a great feeling that is. It was like that with The Irishman, actually. And I scored this, but he's not interested in a traditional score. He says, oh, as long as it doesn't sound like movie music. So I've got to do music for a movie, but it can't sound like movie music. That eliminates a lot of possibilities right there. So anyway, I discovered something that could live over the 50 years that this movie takes place in. And that was a chore. It was a chore, and I found something, and I did something I've never done before in my life. That's exciting.
That is exciting.
You know, and the music for The Irishman and music for the Once Were Brothers documentary, it all got stirred up in the album I was making, Cinematic. You know, there's music on there that is in both of these things, and it was like all of this stuff coming together. I've never had that experience before either. And I don't know, it just became such a great feeling when it works.
Daniel, what did you, at the end of this whole process, you have your film, you screened it, you've locked it. What did you learn about filmmaking from working on this? As we were just talking about filmmaking and Martin Scorsese, what did you learn about filmmaking in this process?
So I think the biggest thing for me was just a way to envision my films before I make them. And what this process taught me more than anything is that I have to be able to envision how my film is going to feel before I make it, if that makes sense. And so I used to be able to close my eyes and see the scene play in my head. But what I do now is I can watch the scene play in my head and I can feel I want it to impact the audience. I was able to work with an editor called Paul Crowder, who's a legendary mm-hmm. editor, who just taught me so much, who was such an extraordinary mentor to me. Those are probably some of the elements that I'm most grateful for as I look back on the journey.
What's a one moment in the film, when people watch it, that you really want them to pay attention to? Is there some little magic moment, something even in the edit room you were so psyched worked, something that is just really gets to what you were trying to accomplish?
So there's a couple moments like that. I watched a film last night for the first time in a long time. And there's one part of the story where the guys are on tour with Bob Dylan, and it's really challenging. They're being booed because Bob Dylan's decided to play electric music as opposed to folk music. And what ends up happening is that Levon, who is the leader of the Hawks and the idol of all these guys, he's just the man, decides that he can't cope with this booing. He doesn't want to deal with it. And he leaves the group. And this is crushing. And what happens is a couple months go by, maybe 6 months or a year, and then this band, they regroup in Woodstock without Levon. And they start writing these songs and recording this music. And they realize there's something missing. And they need to get Levon back. And there's this music cue we use called Ain't No More Cain on the Brazos. Is that right? That's what it's called, Robbie? Mm-hmm. And it's like a chain gang folk song from Texas that Levon sings so soulfully, and we use that cue for when Levon comes back. And every time that song comes on, I'm like, nailed it. That's a great moment in the movie.
Robbie, as you look back on the film, you think about your life and you're watching it, is there anything you would have done differently, any decision you would have made differently about a relationship with Levon, with family, with, I don't know, any decision you made along the way that you think, I might have done something a bit differently there?
You're not talking about within the film, you're talking about within the life.
Within the life, yeah.
Well, you know, like I was saying earlier, you know, we grow and we were growing in different directions, and I didn't know that after The Last Waltz and after we took some time and Levon was able to make a record on his own and Rick made a record on his own and I was working on other things, and then we were going to come back together again, and it didn't happen. And there was a time when we were had it set up, we were going to meet, and I write about this in my book, that I went to the studio that we were going to meet in, and nobody else showed up. And I thought, well, I've got to read the writing on the wall here. It's, you know, if that's the way it is, I'm going to have to, you know, I'm going to have to accept these changes. I'm going to have to accept what everybody's individual path is now. So we went in different directions, and I had a lot of stuff that I wanted to experience and learn in my work and in my life as well. And over time, it was sad for me that Levon really hit some hard times, health-wise and his mental state and everything. And he, you know, became, you know, I hate to say this word, but he got quite bitter about things. And, you know, and he was saying, and I knew this about him. I knew, because years earlier, he would be angry with the booking guy. He'd be angry at the lawyer, angry at the accountant, angry at the manager. That was kind of his nature. And he'd run out of all those people now, and he was left with me. And when he said some things, you know, about me, I chose not. I thought, I'm not gonna go after somebody who's having a rough time. I'm just gonna try to be bigger than that. And I know him, and I understood that, and I still loved him. And it was so sad eventually that his illness, you know, really got him and it killed him. And for me, the idea that I lost Richard Manuel, I lost Rick Danko, I lost Levon Helm, it was heartbreaking. I grew up with these guys, you know. We were as close as you can be. And I just put it in that place, in this very warm, soulful place. And that's how I chose to feel about these guys. And Levon was like my blood brother. And so even more so with him, I was like, all of this stuff, it doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is the incredible life experiences that we had together.
My guests have been Robbie Robertson and Daniel Rohr. The name of the documentary is Once We're Brothers, Robbie Robertson and the Band. Gentlemen, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks
this was fun.
Us.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.